today things.
And that's why you have to just, like you said earlier, have a plan, because all of that could have been avoided by just doing some research, making some calls and saying, can I move my grandmother to Michigan or wherever?
Yeah.
And then he would have been told that her insurance would only cover her if she stayed in the state.
And the kicker was, when grandma started needing full-time care, Jake and his wife wanted to move to Florida, but then they couldn't, because now they couldn't move grandma. So if they had just let her stay in Florida and go with the plan, it would have been so much better.
Well, that, as I said, when you talked about putting a plan together, we all need to have one. Do any of your ladies, are they resistant about putting a plan together when you talk to them about that? Or is it just makes good common sense, but sometimes people just don't have
are resistant sense. Because they can already be overwhelmed and go, okay, now I have to do something else. But I have worked with a few people who have put together plans and come back and said, oh, my mother just ended up in the hospital, but I already knew what to do because we had already worked through it. So it was just the emotion of having a loved one in the hospital, not trying to figure out everything else at the same time.
You have given us so much good information. I so appreciate you being on the show with me today. Can you just, again, give all of our listeners your information, how they can reach you, your website, your email address?
Again, my website is jodihempel.com. Pretty simple, just my name.
Okay.
And my email is jody.essesinsam.hempel@gmail.com. And that information is also on my website.
Anything else? Again, tell them about Daughterhood and where are the meetings held?
They're on Zoom. We used to meet in person at a local assisted living facility, but when COVID hit, that all changed. So we're online, and all the information is on my website under resources for caregivers.
Wonderful. We thank you again so much for joining us. And I want to thank all of my listeners for their continued support. Please visit us on boomgoddessradio.com and subscribe to our YouTube channel, Boom Goddess Radio. I will see you on the radio next week, and this is Jennifer signing off.
KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon, a liberated zone. Listen to community radio, support community radio. It belongs to us.
Andy, whoa, whoa, looks a scream. Andy, mona, whoa, whoa, whoa. Andy, whoa, whoa, silver scream. Can't tell them apart at all.
My name is Joseph Gallivan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is sculptor Matthew Picton. His show, The Age of Carly, Age of Belief, is on now at the Elizabeth Leach Gallery through October 29th. Thanks very much for doing Art Focus by Zoom, Matthew.
Well, thank you, and thank you for having me, Joseph, on the show here. So,
I went to your opening a few weeks ago here in Portland, and we chatted a bit, and it was so good seeing these works in person. They're very big, you know, they're like 6x6, some of them, feet.
Not quite as large as that, but getting there, yeah. They're over 5 feet square, so they are very heavy, yeah.
And they're thick. I mean, the readers should understand, these are circular images built up usually of three layers.
I can run through that. I mean, the first layer is usually sandwiched between two sheets of plexiglass on the surface, and it's paper, and that's there to keep it completely flat. And then the rear layers, it varies. Sometimes I'm using a plastic paper, sometimes it's more paper, Sometimes, you know, there may be a layer in between that's been cut out. It's usually paper, but I use sort of stains and inks and other things like that. And there's always a depth to them. So when you see the kind of image on screen, and unfortunately, it's just a two-dimensional image, not the whole story.
Yeah, so there's the top surface is the plexiglass, then another layer of imagery, and then there's something, the back of the frame, like the backboard. So as you move your head, you're getting this constant shifting of images. They come and go.
That's right. It's much more mobile than if it was just a printed two-dimensional plane image. And of course, you can see inside, so you know the perspective changes depending where you stand.
Mm-hmm. So one of the show is called The Age of Carly, Age of Belief. One of the main ones that really strikes is called New Delhi Number One, The Age of Carly, and it looks like a planet covered in little spikes. There is lots of red and yellow, and it's very it looks like there's fire going on and clouds and water. It's just a very complicated image. What are the basic image sources for this piece?
Your description was good. It has a sort of meteor-like appearance. Image-wise, on that surface, the actual imagery is an image of Goddess Kali that's been multiplied. But Goddess Kali has been cut through with other forms. So there are other forms, other religious forms peering through that as well in multiple. So it's quite confusing. And there's this stormy landscape of thunder clouds that form that kind of swirling vortex-like look on the surface that have also been cut through the central imagery. When you look into the piece, you can see the seven cities of New Delhi. There were seven former cities. So there's fragmented imagery of the mausoleums and mosques and monuments that sort of punctuate the Delhi megalopolis in today, the ruins of. And then the central concentric form in the centre is the British Imperial City. It was the centre of the British Empire, and the British built a very sort of formalised structure in the middle, including the Viceroy's House, which is in the very centre of the piece, which is today is known as the Rashtrapati Bhavan, which is the President of India's house now. So those would be the forms that you're seeing inside that piece there.
So there is sort of black on gold street patterns.
That's right.
The furthest layer away from the viewer, is that right?
Yes, that's right. The black is the street network, and then the rest are images of the mosques and monuments that have been backed in gold leaf and then preserved in a sort of kind of a clear overlay, so that the light can come through the piece from the back.
Mm-hmm. Now you've worked for a long time with maps. How do you get these maps down on... And this is paper, right? The back layer.
Yes. I've worked with maps for a long time, and I don't typically use the actual map itself, the physical map, but I copy it and then cut it through whatever topics and subjects and imagery that I'm using. In this current show, we have two pieces that have mapped formats. None of the other pieces do. So I'm sort of breaking away from that to some extent, really. It's becoming less of a central feature in my work.
Mm-hmm. What to you is the beauty or the value of maps
artwork? Yes, well, to me, maps are sort of a kind of a world of imagination to me. It's like I see a map, I think people do, and they imagine, especially if they're familiar with it themselves within the format or their lives, perhaps where they grew up or where they're from. And so I like that, and they have a very sort of macro view to them at the same time. I mean, to me, it allows for an appreciation of topography and landscape at the same time.
Mm-hmm. And they are like essentially storytelling images.
I think you're right there, yeah.
Mm-hmm. You just can't... I mean, if you've been to the place... You're triggered with memories.
Absolutely, yeah.
If you haven't, you're sort of triggered with fantasies.
Or imaginations of the history of a particular place. I mean, I used to make pieces that were just more about the mapping. And then one day I was making a sculpture of Berlin. This was about 15 years ago. And I started thinking, well, you know, you couldn't help but imagine the history. And so I started, I got hold of these older maps from the 30s and 20s. And then your imagination of the period just grew from there. And so that started the idea of introducing historical form and content into the works.
Then you have a New Delhi number 2,
yeah,
1947. So the first one is called New Delhi number 1, The Age of Kali. What's the relation between these two pieces?
Well, there's quite a lot of relationships in terms of actual physical material, but we're looking at a very specific period in piece number 2. So piece number 2, the street network is actually the bit that was peeled out from between all of the photographs in the first one. So it's a gold-backed sector. And the surface is the surface form is the same surface form as the first one, except the imagery has been changed. And the imagery on the new piece is an imagery of people boarding a train that has all been cut through that imagery. And 1947 was a very sort of pivotal and challenging year in New Delhi, where the city changed forever. So several million people exited the city to Pakistan, the Muslim population, and several million Hindus also arriving from what is now Pakistan. So mm-hmm. there was an enormous sort of shift of population and incredible sort of turbulence and strife, etc., before it sort of settled back down into the current city of New Delhi.
Mm-hmm. And the second piece, New Delhi number 2, I mean, it's a lot. It seems more regular. There's not the chaos of the first one.
There's a lot of
horizontal lines. Even the spikes seem to just be on the outside.
Right.
The image is less spherical.
Yes, that's
like a sunburst. Yeah. What about the color scheme in this one?
Well, the color scheme. I mean, I was thinking about how 1947 also was the end of the British Empire, but certainly the end of British India. And to me, that sort of dusky pink colour that's behind it is like a big sort of like a big sun that's ending in some ways. I mean, it's a very sort of Indian colour in some ways as well. So mm-hmm. that's made of a poured of poured inks on Yupo.
Poured inks on what?
On the plastic paper, so mm-hmm. that it, you know, pools and moves around and creates that sort of, you know, the swirls that are inside the mm-hmm. background there.
These are so beautifully finished works. I mean, they're kind of like clocks. You know, when you look inside a clock and there are different layers of cogs right. that all work together. How do you assemble these? Which layer do you work on first?
Yes, it's quite a procedure. I mean, everything obviously has to be lined up perfectly and mounted to the back and measured very carefully. And then the front layer has to be very carefully placed between the two sheets of plexiglass and put down into the frame. And a space is created and the rear mounted layer is placed in on top and screwed in from the back. So, yeah.
I imagine, you know, 50 years ago, this would have all been hand done, X-Acto knife. Do you use automation?
Yeah, no, there's no automation in my work.
No lasers?
No lasers, yes, how about that? I mean, you know, I could use one for an exterior sculpture potentially. It could be done in metal or something, but as the work goes, I like the element of the handmade and the hand, because in actually cutting the forms out, there's always micro decisions have to be made as to sort of thickness or thinness of line and everything else and bits that are omitted. And a machine is just going to do a very sort of methodical but calculated job. And so I don't think it'd be the same thing at all.
Mm-hmm. So as in the process of using your hand, you're making changes to the idea that the piece as you go.
Yes, definitely.
Whereas a computer would just output it.
Well, it would output it. It would have a format and a form, and it would then a formula, and it would just apply it across the board, right? So this is never like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's adjustment. And then in terms of putting the piece together, there's there's a lot of adjustments. I mean, it's, you know, it's the sort of central form of the front is fairly defined by the template that's been applied, but as to how it's going to line up and be placed and balanced with the rear layer and what has to happen in that process, that's a different thing. It's you know, it requires time sometimes, quite a lot of time to
because they seem so worked out. I'm wondering how. Do you experiment by moving everything to the left, a millimeter, see what happens?
Well, I mean, I've usually got the kind of central form on the front pretty set, but as to how it's going to work out the back, that I experiment with. You know, that's usually I balance it up on poles to start with and shift bits around underneath and see how it's working and see if that's going to work. And even when I've done it, I might have to kind of tonally change it in some way. It just depends, because the two layers have to interact with each other in a way that they work, that neither are fighting with the other, because essentially the surface form has two forms upon it. There's the visual image, and then there's all the cut form, which has a different set of images. And so you can lose all that by a background that's too strong, or it's, you know, you can lose one of those things straight away. And so essentially the surface layer is two layers and the rear layer is usually one layer.
Mm-hmm. Another one that really stands out is just called Hajj, which is a pilgrimage. It's all Hajj Mecca.
That's right.
It's the pilgrimage to Mecca, and it's in Muslim green. It's this light green, sort of pea green background, and then a lot of the imagery is geometric forms, and they're in green as well, and there's a lot of grey and blue. But the background green, it looks like poured ink or, you know, some kind of watery.
Yes.
Ripples. What is that background?
Well, it is indeed a poured ink. I mean, this was a piece which sort of exemplifies what we were just talking about, in that sense that the need to balance the layers, it was very difficult, because that surface layer has imagery of the Hajj in Mecca on the surface, and it's actually been cut through one of this very famous ceiling from the mosque in Isfahan, and this is rather fabulous and beautiful pattern that the mosque ceiling has, and below there's poured ink that's been poured onto a sort of semi-opaque sheets of Duralar, and that's such that you can then see the forms below that, and below that you've got the circle of people at prayer around the mosque inside Mecca. And the problem with all of the sort of kneeling, praying forms of the people there was that it was just cancelling out the top layer completely. So I had to introduce a layer between the two where you could see those forms to some degree. And then the green, well, the green was, of course, a good colour to choose, because that is, you know, it's a very sort of the colour of paradise in Islam. So.
Oh, is that right? Paradise?
That's right, yeah.
Presumably, did you visit?
Can't go
to Mecca, but you know, did you go to Saudi?
That's right. I mean, you know, of course, I'd love to go to Mecca, but it's not something that we're allowed to do. You know, I've had to just imagine it.
But you know New Delhi quite well.
I know Delhi. Yes, I've been to New Delhi a few times. Yeah, I mean, different times. I mean, it's a fairly overwhelming city.
Mm-hmm. What's the difference between working on a city you know and one that you can only imagine?
I think it is very different. I mean, if you've been, you you have the kind of all of the impressions and atmosphere of the place, but it doesn't rule out doing a city that you haven't been to. It's just that it's just a purely imaginary sphere that you have to guess at. And I mean, I like to have been to the place, but it's not absolutely a prerequisite that you have to have been, because there's enough ways to kind of see it, so to speak, through various media or to read about it or that kind of thing. So, yeah.
My name is Joseph Gallivan. You are listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is sculptor Matthew Picton. His show, The Age of Carly, Age of Belief, is on now at the Liz Leach Gallery through October 29th. Another one of these pieces is very different in form. It's called The Angels and the Horns. Again, it's a hand-cut archival pigment print, but it's got, it's a circle, but it's got things sticking out from it. So it's an irregular circle. Those things are wings. So these are, you know, it's angel wings and trumpets, very biblical. What is the central person in the middle? There's like a guy's head and he's got robes.
Oh, yes. Well, that the central person is God in the center. I mean,
God the Father?
Yes, God the Father. I mean, it's that piece is it's taken from the South Rose window in Chartres Cathedral. And that window is a window of the apocalypse. And it's, you know, it's a very sort of famous window in that cathedral. The imagery that's been cut through it is various parts of Dürer's woodcuts of angels, and particularly the angels being given the horns, sounding the call of the apocalypse, you know, the final call of the end of the world. And so I've rearranged the angels into a sort of top template and cut through these, through those, and through the form of the window with all of those angels. And so it's a sort of a combining of the same subject in many ways and from the same period. I mean, Chartres Cathedral was 1350s, 1400, those windows would have been created, and Dürer was creating these images in 1496 or 7, roughly.
It's got that, you know, woodcut, black and white,
yep,
a solid kind of basic graphic art, you know, but then it's got these colors, psychedelic kind of overlay of reds and blues.
Yes, that's right.
Then they're totally contradictory to me, you know, right. It's like you've jumped 600 right. years.
Yeah.
What made you do that?
Well, it was really, I mean, it was more about the combining of those forms, and it was just a sort of, well, it was going to be interesting to see how the coloured forms were going to operate with that sort of woodcut, sort of fairly graphic imagery at the same time, which was going to fragment what there already was with the other imagery. It was a combining of two things on the one plane, basically, with some shadowing behind it.
What's the one called that has the Wailing Wall in it?
That's called the Well of Souls.
Oh, okay.
And that was an interesting piece to kind of come into me. I wanted to make a piece about Jerusalem, obviously. And there's, you know, there's a lot of elements to doing a piece about Jerusalem with its very lengthy history and its divisions and the past and the present and its sort of divided nature. And so eventually the wall became a kind of the most important single feature when you think about it. Obviously, there's the modern day wall as well. And so I felt I could allude to all that with just this image of the Wailing Wall. And the Wailing Wall is such a powerful image with the Jewish faith praying there for 2,000-3,000 years with the same wall. And the site of the previous two Jewish temples with the Dome of the Rock built on the top with the Muslim faith. So, and it has, and then underneath that dome, it's like for the Jewish faith, it's the center of the world. It's where God brought the world into being. And meanwhile, it's also where Prophet Muhammad ascended to heaven. And it's underneath the rock, there's a well. Apparently, there's a cave underneath. And this is what's known as the Well of Souls. And the Well of Souls is apparently, according to certainly an older sort of Islamic belief, it's where people would line up to await Judgment Day underneath there in the Well of Souls. So it seemed very sort of a very powerful title and a very sort of powerful allusion generally.
Do you have a bunch of other religions up your sleeve that you're working on?
Yes, well, of course, you know, had I had time and had I quite sort of been like, well, it's only just coming into being, is of course the piece that's missing in some ways from those, particularly with Mecca and Jerusalem, is Rome. And I've been thinking about how to do this. I've finally started. It's going to be a big piece, and I'm just working on the template with St. Peter's and the whole thing. It's going to be, I mean, it's looking to be, going to be a pretty dramatic piece. I feel like there's going to be more than one piece come out of this too. So yeah, so I'm quite excited to sort of get started on this.
Mm-hmm. I mean, when you're conceiving the work, do you think in layers? Do you think one layer has to be a certain type of image?
Yeah, usually. But with this one, I'm taking sort of multiple approaches here. You know, I'm mainly thinking about that template, the surface layer, and I'm thinking about what imagery might combine with that. But I know that you can't predict, because it depends how it's going to work out. So this is going to take several approaches, and we'll see how it goes. And it's going to be a few months before the results come through, I think.
Mm-hmm. I mean, do you ever make an entire layer and cut it all out by hand and then just scrap it and change your mind?
No, it never goes that badly. It's a bit depressing. It takes a lot of work. So even if your approach isn't right, it can be moved into some other way eventually. I mean, you might have to shelve it for a bit, but mm-hmm. No, that's not happened to me, luckily.
Mm-hmm. And where does the creativity come from? Is it something you wake up thinking about, oh, I'm going to try this? Or?
Yeah, definitely. You know, it's like one of the best places to think about it is definitely lying in bed, right? You know, mm-hmm. like you'll be lying there in the middle of the night, perhaps, or early in the morning, and or it might just come to you. You know, it might just, you think, oh, yes, of course, you know, and it just takes time for that to occur, because, you know, I mean, I might start with the idea I'm going to work on something about Rome, but, you know, it really might take me 6 months or longer until I'm actually kind of aware of how I'm going to do it. Meanwhile, I'm looking at imagery and I'm looking at drawings, I'm researching, I'm looking for stuff to see what might work. Mm-hmm. But that's going to be a whole time-consuming thing itself. Mm-hmm. Looking for books.
Yeah, you could spend a whole afternoon on the couch looking at YouTube 4K drone videos of Rome.
Yeah, maybe that you could do. I'm sure there's loads of them.
Is the drone changing the way you work?
Well, not me, because I haven't done that, you see. So, I mean, but I guess if you're in, you know, you can no doubt create sort of layered videos out of video footage. I'm sure there's people doing all that already. There must be. Mm-hmm.
You know? I think they just change the perspective, you know, filmmaking, you get that shot like all the time.
Yeah.
The end of history. Yes. So these are there's two. The end of history, suffering widens, and survivors found. These are a rectangular, black and white. So suffering widens. It looks like a skull with a crown. He's smoking a cigar, and I think that's an oak leaf in front. Is that right?
Yeah, that is probably an oak leaf in front. So, well, I can tell you about these pieces because they obviously they relate to the current war. That one's a good one to start with talking about, because, like everybody, I've been, you know, fairly transfixed and rather perhaps horrified by how the war's progressing and how it started.
Which war?
The Ukraine-Russian war.
Okay.
Pieces are about. And the first, the thing that kept coming to mind was this, you know, I've read a lot around the subject of Russian history, and I've also kind of, I had these books where there was all of these prison tattoos from Siberia and the likes that have been documented by a prison warder over several decades, right, particularly back in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s, and they created this amazing, rather sort of like a sort of a negative mirror of Russian history. It's like, and there is some quote, all of Russian history can be found inscribed on the bodies of the prisoners. And that image with the crown, that was the image of the authority, the gangster boss. You didn't just, none of these tattoos could you just wear just for fashion. I mean, it was like if you went to prison and you had one of those tattoos and you just applied it to yourself and it wasn't a lived experience, they would cut it off you. So the crown, so of course the first thing you think once Putin invades, you think the crown, the gangster boss. And since Putin took over, the KGB has had a lot of sort of contacts with those crime bosses from the prison system and those who are not in the prison system, such that, you know, you could say it was a sort of semi-criminal enterprise. And so that was the image that I kept thinking about, and I remembered this, you know, it's an important image in those books. So I basically got front pages from certain newspapers, kind of more or less in the first few weeks of the war, and cut the tattoo forms through those front pages, and the title, The End of History. There was a Ukrainian historian who coined the phrase the end of history, because he sort of felt that once the war started, it felt like the end of history. I mean, obviously there's not the end of history, but it's a sort of poignant title. In a sense, it feels like the end of a certain type of history or a certain type of period, because whatever sort of, however things have gone along since World War II, it's all sort of ended and changed now. And so it's the end of a type of history. So that's the title. And then Suffering Widens is taken from the headline, one of the sort of headlines on the front page of that particular front page that was used in that one.
Mm-hmm. So you took the New York Times, you reversed it, so it's white on black.
Yeah.
In some cases it's black on white.
Yeah.
It's really beautiful. It's just so awkward and strange to see a newspaper reversed.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, it was a good way of doing it. It was partly because it wasn't going to work otherwise. You know, it's like because visually there has to be enough sort of contrast separation between the layers. So I needed to do that with that particular one.
Talking of the end of history, do you think you've got a Queen Elizabeth II picture in you?
Oh, no. Well, I don't think so. I mean, the Queen, you know, I don't know how you feel about it. I mean, obviously, the Queen, she did a great job, but, you know, she's somewhat of an anachronism and is not really, like, doesn't have any real power. You know, she's just a figurehead. So to me, she's got nothing much to do with history beyond the fact that her reign spanned a period of time from 53 to the present. But she was not shaping that history in the way that other leaders or other sort of events in history have done. So
my name's Joseph Gallivan. You've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week was Matthew Picton. His show, The Age of Carly, The Age of Belief, is on now at the Elizabeth Leach Gallery through October 29th. Thanks very much for doing Art Focus by Zoom.